This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We feature a lot of composers, important composers, on this program, many of them in the first stages of their careers. However, we can tend to be a bit New York myopic and centered in that endeavor. Today, we'll chat with a rising composer based in my hometown of Chicago, Misha Zupko. He came from a musical, even composition-laden family, with a relative as close as his father being a well-known and established composer. My guest started out as a performing artist on piano, but by his mid-20s was hooked on the creative side of music-making. Awards, prizes, commissions, and residencies have followed. Even outside of Chicago, his works have been praised by the New York Times to the Los Angeles Times. A new CD of his chamber music has just been released on CD Records, with a very timely piece included, as we'll hear in a moment. Right now, you're listening to the opening movement titled Shadow from his four-movement work Shades of Grey for violin and piano, Sangmi Lee on violin, and the composer at the piano. I spoke with Misha Zupko by phone a few weeks back. very happy to be visiting today with composer slash pianist. We'll get to that. Misha Zupko. We're recording this 1 week after the big eclipse day. This will air a number of weeks after that. But I think it's kind of cool when people think that new music has no relevance to today's society. Where a week ago, you had a performance of your piece Eclipse at an Eclipse event. You want to just sort of quickly tell our audience what happened there?
Sure. Yeah. No. And I want to clarify that this was not a preconceived motive by any stretch of the imagination. When I wrote Eclipse, you know, this was back in 2014. I had no knowledge at the time that there was going to be a solar eclipse in 2017. And so when this came about, it was just kind of a happy convergence of things. And, you know, the publicist at Sadie, who's sitting here with me, Nat Silverman, did a brilliant run of publicity around the solar eclipse, you know, as kind of a resurgence of our publicity for the CD. And we got all this incredible response. So the week of, it was Monday, it was the week before the eclipse, I got inspired by all of his work. And I thought, you know, really, we should be doing something, you know, around the eclipse. And so I started coming up with these harebrained ideas that were going nowhere. And my wife actually said, you know, you're going to spend a lot of money doing those things. And, you know, you're probably, you know, be playing in the middle of a field for nobody. Why don't you, you know, consider going to the Botanic Gardens and, you know, seeing if you could set up a performance there? And it was like a light bulb went off. And it was still kind of a long shot because, I mean, you know, these events don't exactly take place overnight most times. I mean, I'm sure the Botanic Gardens had been, you know, planning for this for well over a year, especially with the foot traffic that they had. But we went for it and, you know, I called the front desk and my colleague Song Mi Lee had somebody behind the curtain that she knew there. And we just put this thing together within the week. And not only did we have to put this together, but we also had to find a cellist to play Eclipse because Wendy Warner could not come in for that performance. So it was a rather harrowing week, but so worth it. And we were set up at one of the pavilions in the gardens and, you know, had a lovely audience. And we performed a program at 11:30, which was before the peak viewing. But that gave us an opportunity to kind of talk about what the program was and how this was, you know, meant to enhance or collaborate with the day, and specifically with the title track Eclipse, which is truly written to emulate the experience of an eclipse and, you know, being able to explain that to the audience. And then when it was peak viewing time, we performed the piece again, trying to get the convergence that happens in the music to coincide with the convergence of the moon covering the sun. So it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, it was a really great way to have new music tied into not only science, but something that everybody was thinking about, whether they went and viewed it or not, you know? Yeah, I was in New York City that day, and everybody took their lunch hour at that time.
There's something so magical about events like this. It's the one, you know, time and sometimes in a lifetime that you witness everybody being quiet for just a moment, you know, everybody, literally everybody, and just, you know, being able to understand the miracle that is our life.
Yeah.
And for musicians and composers, I mean, that's what art is and music is to us. You know, it's this ability to mine the otherworldly, to be able to see beyond our kind of corporeal selves and, you know, just demonstrate that for people, try to share that experience with people. And this was just a great way to be able to combine these two experiences and make, you know, hopefully make them even more powerful.
So here is his work, which proved timely, his Eclipse for violin and cello. Once again, Song Mi Lee on violin and Wendy Warner on cello. Music by my guest today, Misha Zupko. Let's back up on you a bit. You were born into a very musical family. One could even say a composition-centered family.
Right.
So it might have been a foregone conclusion, possibly, that you would be a musician. A composer was another question mark. In fact, you didn't even come to it till your mid-20s, making a firm decision. And that's even later than Tchaikovsky and Schoenberg. So I just talk about what it was growing up. Was music just going to be your life? And then why so late into the creative side of
it? Sure. Yeah, I mean, I would say that music really was my choice. You know, I mean, I think with a lot of people who are born into musical families, you know, it can go either way. It can be something that is just, you know, well, it's the family trade, you know, you do it because, you know, it's in the genes. But I remember from a very early age, even before I was three, you know, sitting, you know, near my dad while he was playing the piano, and he would be playing through the Well-Tempered Clavier. And yeah, you know, there was a very particular piece that I wanted to learn. I still remember it today. It's, you know, it's the C sharp major prelude from book one. And I was chomping at the bit to be able to start my lessons. And so we did start, you know, when I was very young at the age of three. And it was a combination of joy and sorrow, for sure. I mean, I know even more, you know, where that sorrow comes from now, being a father of a young person who is also very talented as a musician. And I try to impart my wisdom. And sometimes that isn't so easy to do, you know, given that close relationship. But I really identified with myself as a pianist. I did grow up, you know, writing compositions periodically, but that was more at my father's behest. My father, Raymond Zupko, is a composer, for those who don't know. And he would have me enter a competition every year with a composition. And, you know, I willingly obliged. But I never found the gratification in that at that age. I mean, I got more gratification out of the physicality and the direct communication that I could have as a performer when I was younger. But then when I went off to college and, you know, I had finished my degree in piano with Emilio Del Rosario at Northwestern University and David Kaiserman as well, I took some time off and I did a lot of practicing. I did, you know, a lot of vocal accompanying and, you know, some teaching and just trying to figure out where, you know, I was going to be heading with all of this. And my friend Aaron Johnson and I took a spontaneous trip to Europe. Well, maybe not so spontaneous. It was a month long, so we did do a little preparing. But we toured around Europe for a month. And, you know, while we were there, we were visiting the graves of our favorite composers and, you know, some of their apartments and seeing manuscripts and getting all inspired by the fact that this is the birthplace of, you know, our trade and everything that we care about. And my friend Aaron had been kind of composing in his head while he was out there. And, you know, when I came home, I caught the bug as well. And I felt like all of a sudden I needed to at least take a stab at it. And so I started very feebly working out something, piano piece, and sounded exactly like Ondine from Gaspar de la Nuit. And so I immediately threw it out and forgot about it. But then, you know, like 2 days later, all of a sudden I felt like, you know, well, I got to try this one more time. And this just started to generate some material that I was really kind of happy with. And throughout that year, with some encouragement from my friend Aaron and also Mignon Dunn, who was teaching in the vocal department at Northwestern, an old New York Metropolitan Opera singer, so was, you know, very encouraging of what I was trying to do and set up a meeting for me with John Corigliano, who happened to be a next-door neighbor of hers in New York. So this was my big opportunity to, you know, before I even knew what I was doing, to try to network. And I got wonderfully lucky in that I found a free moment when John Corigliano was visiting Chicago for the premiere of his Ghosts of Versailles to get him on an off day when, you know, he had a lot of time. And I spent probably 3 or 4 hours with him that day. And he, you know, also gave me a lot of encouragement and said, you know, of course, at this point, before I'd hardly written my way out of two pieces, that maybe I should explore getting into a graduate school somewhere. And he gave me some suggestions. And that's, you know, kind of when I pounced on IU and said, I'm here. Yeah. And I was very fortunate that they were able to accept me as, you know, kind of a beginning student in a master's program. But I did a lot of remedial work and I had great mentors there. So it was a perfect situation.
Yeah, John's been a guest on Cadenza and his time is incredibly precious. Even now where he's scaled back and sort of doesn't take anything, he's still swamped with everything. As our listeners have heard, you were performing. You were a pianist. In fact, on the Eclipse recording, it's you on piano. So you still keep this up, though that's not wholly rare to have a composer as pianist playing even their own works. The composer slash performer has really come back with gusto over the last decades or so, last say, two decades. And I think of other composers like out here, like Timo Andrus, who is a vital performer and a composer. And I'm wondering, did that, in listening to what you said about what happened, did it hold you back because you're a performer? Has it been beneficial? I mean, this is a new thing. 34 years ago, it would have been odd to have a composer be so committed to be a performer.
Right. Well, I mean, personally, just in terms of how I work, I find being a performer helps me to empathize better as a composer. It helps me to make physical what I'm writing on the page, too. There's a certain visceral quality about music that can get overlooked at times if you're not in that moment. And I find having those performing skills and having that experience really does help me connect with that physicality that does communicate very directly to an audience. I'm not talking about, you know, kind of show emotions as you're performing your piece, but just the physicality of creating the music and even how that comes through in the sound. So I mean, I find it incredibly valuable. It also keeps your muscles flexed when it comes to working with other musicians. Because as a composer, I mean, I think one of our most vital skill sets is being able to communicate with performers about how we want to shape the music that we're writing. Right. And we want to be able to also listen to what they have to say, too. It's really a symbiotic relationship. And if you don't have a lot of practice doing that, you know, it's something you have to think about a lot and something, you know, you have to learn. So, you know, I think those things are incredibly beneficial for doing it. And plus, you know, it's just fun to perform.
It's just such a healthy trend to go back to the composer, performer, performer, composer. It's, you know, it does. It links things that maybe became unlinked in the 50s and 60s and even part of the 70s. The middle part of the 20th century. Some points about your works. First, should people take into account the titles you give your works before they listen to them?
The old WC argument.
I know. Well, I mean, your titles are, I mean, there's the new violin concerto, but they're not Sonata Number 1. I mean, but they're vague, too. There's also a vagary to them. So.
Right. Well, I mean, titles are something that I do think a lot about. Sometimes they predate a piece, and sometimes they come in the middle of a piece, and sometimes, you know, I don't have one until I'm finished. So there's no formula for coming up with them. But I do find them kind of gateways into the pieces. I mean, you know, not everybody needs that. And for those who don't need it, then ignore it. But I found that having evocative titles, having kind of evocative narratives that go with the music that you're writing, you know, can help the creative process and can also help people enter into that creative process with you. So when I do have the opportunity to talk with audiences or be able to demonstrate my works in any sort of ways, these are great ways for me to be able to say, it's okay to hear this however you want to, but if you're having any difficulty whatsoever, you know, here's a way to start. And a lot of the reason I think why I write music is to bring people into an experience. I want to communicate a very specific experience. I don't want to just play in my mental playground and then hope for the best. You know, I really have, you know, as everybody does, have wonderful, magical experiences in life, and then some not so wonderful and not so magical. But I want to try to capture the spirit of those, like the eclipse. You know, what is it about a cosmic event that makes us all hush? What is it that stirs the soul when we see that? And you know, all of a sudden, everything's put into perspective, and you know, no longer are we just, you know, flesh and bones walking around on this planet, but we're open to the universe. How do you capture that? And you certainly can't, well, you know, a really good writer can capture it through analogy and through imagery. And I guess through music, you have that added advantage of resonating tones, mm-hmm. you know, to try to emulate those experiences. And so for me, the titles are just kind of sealing of that package. It kind of puts a word, you know, it gives us a sign as to what that experience is going to be.
Here are the opening minutes from my guest Misha Zipko's work for cello and piano called Fallen. Wendy Warner again on cello, the composer at the piano, this from a new CD of his chamber music released on the CD Records label. Another thing is a number of reviews of your music have mentioned emphasis, and they praise the virtuosity of the works, which I think is just a code word for maturity. So I don't know how you view those comments, ever they're accurate. And if they are accurate, why is that important to you that the music has a level that comes across as not difficult and not thorny and not, you know, obtuse, but something that accomplished musicians would want to take up? You know, I think you know what I'm saying there.
Right. I think because I, growing up, always desired a challenge, I loved to learn the pieces that I wasn't supposed to learn. Mm. My dad always told me, you know, you're not ready for the fourth Chopin ballade, you know, when I'm 10. And then, you know, I sneak it out of his drawer and, you know, secretly start to learn the counterpoint, you know. There's something so satisfying about getting deep into a piece and, you know, being able to see all of the layers that contribute to a magical experience. And I don't believe ultimately that multi-layered complex music is definitive of the kind of nirvana experience. Ultimately, each musical moment is dictated by what is necessary. Sometimes it's silence. But there is something very gratifying about being able to put together a web of things and create kind of a composite result that couldn't be created any other way, that's not on the surface. So, yeah, I mean, I think just in the same way painters love to combine paint colors, you know, paint a sky with some yellow. Who would have thought? But, you know, the yellow, you know, even though you're not aware of it, brings a different hue, a different tone to the sky. And all of a sudden you're aware of what time of day it is. I think that that kind of complexity is necessary in a way to communicate anything that's beyond just something that's on the sleeve.
Yeah.
So some of it is kind of an artistic preference, a persuasion. Some of it is the fact that I love virtuosic music. I love to watch virtuoso performers. You know, I aspire to be as virtuosic as I can be given my skill sets as a performer. Again, you know, just that part of it is just plain fun.
Yeah, and like I said, when I read the reviews, it's an odd word to show up sometimes in a review of new music.
Mm.
And I think, like I said, I think it's just a code word that the reviewers, whomever they were, and some are very respected, were just sort of taken aback by the level of the music, you know. As your music has gained an exposure and you've got taken on residencies and things like this, you start to work with some real top-ranked musicians, ensembles.
Right.
So at this point in your career, how hard is that to keep that level? Do you do that by expanding pieces? You might want to talk about the violin concerto thing, but do you expand pieces out to be big? I mean, once you reach there, you want to stay there. You want to keep working with that level. But talk about that.
Right. Yeah, I think this is a process that I continue to explore because, I mean, I think at different points in my career, I've certainly gotten to places that I never expected would happen. I mean, I don't think anybody ever expects when something big happens, you know, but it just does, and it's surprising and wonderful. But continuing that, it is a chore. It's really difficult because, first of all, the audience for classical music is not as large as for other forms of music, let me put it diplomatically. And you've got a lot of people who are creating and creating great things and many different styles and can appeal to so many different areas of the classical music world. And, you know, how do you distinguish yourself? How do you keep that going?
Right.
And at this point, I mean, what I continue to try to do is to try to find opportunities to stage performances of the music, like for instance, the violin concerto. You know, I made an arrangement of that for piano so that I can perform that. We just recently performed that at the Thirsty Ears Music Festival, which is Chicago's only street music festival here that's hosted by Seth Bosted, who actually works here at WFMT for the program he titles Resonant Tones. And so we've had these opportunities to play different places and get the work known in that way, and then creating events around events. I mean, like the Eclipse idea, you know, just trying to tie the music in with people's experiences, because, I mean, I think that that's really where the music becomes relatable. I mean, it's not relatable oftentimes to the lay listener just on its own. It needs some kind of context. And I learned that very early on from my teaching at Indiana University when I was a graduate assistant there. And I had all sorts of students who were there to learn how to write music, but said invariably that they didn't want to write new music. And what do you mean? You know, if you're going to write it today, it's new, you know, but they had a real bias because, you know, they had maybe had one or two bad experiences with hearing a piece of music written within the last 100 years.
Right.
Apparently that
they had the new music
new
class.
Music. Yeah, right. Exactly. And so one day for their convocation, I presented some music for them.
Right.
And actually I presented some films. I did a little clip from Space Odyssey 2001. And then I did a clip from Altered States. And got them to talk about, you know, the music and how it was evocative of the scenes that I was showing. And they were so into this music. You know, with Space Odyssey 2000, of course, it's the Ligeti score. And they're talking about how these high, you know, dissonant clusters in the piccolos are kind of helping them to feel the space that they're entering. And with Altered States, these low oboes all playing unison on this very ritualistic-like melody, you know, kind of just helped them to feel the mushroom trip that William Hurt was on at the right. time. And then after I was done showing those movies and the excitement died down a little bit, I played them two excerpts of some contemporary pieces. You know, of course, I got the expected response, oh, this is horrible, this is just, well, there's no melody, blah, 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 and they just happened to be the exact same excerpts that I had played in the films. Yeah. And so I obviously went in there with some knowledge of what I was trying to accomplish here. And that is that people need context for music. Music has a very special place for people in their memories, in their experiences. And if there isn't a context for a particular person for, you know, a certain kind of music or even a very particular piece of music, then oftentimes it gets rejected out of hand. And so I think really the course towards increasing that ability to get my music out in the world is to, you know, continue to create these contexts in which there's relevance for the music. And then, of course, the normal stuff of shipping it around to everybody that could potentially offer a performance or radio play.
Well, and today, like with YouTube and platforms like that, I mean, your music is being listened to all over the world where it never could have been. But I guess my question was...
I'm sorry.
No. You answered it, but I just wanted to fine-tune it in that as you get more exposure, I mean, the chamber music is great, and now with non-traditional venues doing chamber music and the events like you had with Eclipse, more people hear that. But right. as you work with these top-ranked musicians and ensembles, is it... That's alluring. And of course, it is still, sadly, sometimes the big pieces that really sort of put you on right. the map. So I'm just wondering if that temptation is to just simply keep going bigger and try to keep that level by expanding your compositional world out.
You know? Right. Well, you know, and that's, you know, of course. And I'm constantly working on trying to get the larger pieces performed right. and trying to get larger organizations to commission pieces. And, you know, I've had some, you know, good fortune with that in the past, but that, you know, it doesn't come unless you're constantly on top of that. So, yeah, I mean, I've certainly been communicating with various organizations about the violin concerto in particular, which I'm very proud of, and hope that that can have a life, because that's a piece that's kind of, for me, a culmination of everything that I've been happy with in my work. Yeah, so yeah, a big push for the big performances, certainly.
So let's hear the final minutes of my guest's violin concerto from its premiere performance featuring violinist Sangmi Lee, recorded at Indiana University's Auer Hall with the Indiana University New Music Ensemble under the direction of David Zube. This on March 9th of this year, music by my guest today, Misha Zupko. I think people can hear that I'm speaking to you and you're in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Our listeners know from listening to me that they know Chicago is my hometown, but mm-hmm. I've been out here for a number of years, and we can be pretty New York myopic when mm-hmm. it comes to new music out here. Of course, we've got Bang on the Can, Alarmal Sound, Ice, right. American Composers Orchestra, even here south of us in Philadelphia, Orchestra 2001. And of course, mm-hmm. the whole Brooklyn scene with the Knights and soul percussion stuff. But Chicago is really happening.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, not only fill us East Coasters in, but people listen to us all around the world. So just give us, from a new music perspective, what's exciting about what's happening in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we've just watched the scene explode over the past 15, 20 years. I think it was in the old days, you know, kind of dominated by the university guards, you know, right. especially the University of Chicago. And there was a lot of very cerebral uptown kind of music that was being promoted and the Chicago Symphony would do. And that's great because that certainly gave us, you know, an identity. And we had a lot of brilliant composers and musicians here to be able to do that kind of thing. But, you know, certainly it was somewhat lacking in diversity, I think. And that diversity has certainly opened up over the past 15, 20 years. One of the ensembles that I had the great fortune of working with, the Fulcrum Point New Music Project, is one that really was aimed at opening up Chicago's aesthetic to music of different aesthetic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, and really trying to have a conversation and contextualize that conversation to make music even more broadly culturally relevant. I would say that began in some ways, at least in my mind, the conversation. But since, you know, all sorts of groups have popped up, experimenting with all different models of programming, the Spectral Quartet, the Del Niente, New Music Ensemble, and Fifth House, and Eighth Blackbird, of course, you know, mm-hmm. all reside around here. And in fact, Ice did,
right.
you know, originate here as well. So, I mean, we have all of these wonderful ensembles. And then on top of that, all of these wonderful festivals of new music, and probably the one that came to the most national attention recently was the Ear Taxi Festival, which was spearheaded by Augusta Reed Thomas with Stephen Burns, who is the director and a good friend of mine from Fulcrum Point. And this really celebrated everything that Chicago has to offer over a 5-day period. And we had concerts in every corner of the city, and the cultural center, and, you know, the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, some outdoor things, electronic music, street music. I mean, it was kind of one of these limitless ideals that really all came together and allowed Chicago to see everything that this city has to offer musically. And it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, you saw a coming together of composers and musicians from all different walks in the musical world, just, you know, really celebrating one another.
It's great. When I was doing graduate work back in 1982, way back in the dark ages, I was part of the first New Music Chicago Festival, and my class at Northwestern got to do a piece with John Cage, and that was that was a real highlight. And it's always been a great new music scene, but like you said, sometimes it got subjugated by the large ensembles or a certain conductor who was in town or the academia, and it's great to see it breaking out. I mean, the New York scene is so filled with non-traditional venues where people can go here, and I assume that's happening in Chicago as well.
Oh, yeah, no. We've got new venues popping up all the time. I mean, one of the big new venues that's, you know, attracting just about every splinter group and even some of the larger groups is Constellation. I mean, it's kind of a black box theater, and, you know, there's a lot of experimental stuff being done there with lighting and film and various, you know, sound installations and stuff like that. But there's also some really non-traditional venues, you know, bars and eateries, and sometimes we make our own, like the Chicago Botanic Gardens, you know, I mean, which, you know, is host to putting on and staging musical concerts, but typically not new music concerts. So I think Chicago's pretty open in that way to celebrating and putting new music on a platform.
Well, hopefully with your Eclipse performance where we started this chat, they won't wait till the next one to have new music. But you know, that would be a little too infrequent. Some composers are superstitious about this, but I mean, you want to clue us into what you're working on that you want people to know about?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I was doing in conjunction with the album was I was creating a music video, particularly for the title track Eclipse, and that was with burlesque star Michelle L'Amour. And it seems like kind of a collaboration by chance, but it really was, you know, something very intentional. Michelle is an amazing burlesque artist who really brought the burlesque scene to Chicago and has recently been taking on some very interesting projects and trying to broaden the scope of what burlesque can be, as, you know, all nouveau burlesque artists are trying to do. And she and her husband, Frankie, are very involved in classical music and wanted to try to find ways in order to expand their horizons with the use of classical music in some of what they're doing. And so we created a video to Eclipse, which really has Michelle dancing in and out of shadows. And in some ways, it could very much look like, you know, Martha Graham. Yeah. You know, Michelle has a very strong dance background, but there is the element of burlesque just in some of the facial expressions and whatnot. So that's something that is now out, you know, that your audience could find by going to michellelamour.com and looking at her selected videos there. I'm also working on a saxophone quartet for a consortium of saxophone quartets. One of them was a quartet, the Canary Quartet, that was founded at Indiana University, but now they're kind of all over the states. But they're a wonderful quartet. They put together a consortium of about six or seven quartets that are commissioning this piece. And so that's really the next big project that I have going. And all the while, I've been writing a musical as well, based on the Everly sisters from Chicago. They were these notorious madams.
Yeah,
who,
it's because that's the old brothel house.
Oh, yeah. Right, wow. You know it.
Yeah. Okay. So if you're Chicago, do you know all the underbelly stories of Chicago as well?
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, you know, this was one that I hadn't heard, and surprisingly, a lot of folks, you know, who are dyed-in-the-wool Chicagoans don't know this story, but it's a fascinating one of how two women came into Chicago, very wealthy women, bought out two mansions and started what was the most famous courtesan club in the world on Dearborn and 12th Street. And, you know, the story in and of itself, just, you know, about them building the club wouldn't be interesting if it weren't for the fact that they were really trying to empower women in a time when women didn't have power.
Right.
And so that's really the focus of our story. And it's been an exciting project that we're going to be partnering with American Music Theater Projects and David Bell over at Northwestern University to try to do some more readings on and get this thing into shape for a potential Goodman reading next spring.
What? That sounds very cool. And it is the blurred line between musical theater and opera. It's you're moving towards musical theater as far as just
right. You know, semantics, and I mean, but that again, I think lines are blurred all over the place these days. I mean, you know, what is part of a contemporary music scene is not what it was 20 years ago. You know, rock and roll is as much of a part of a contemporary music scene now as, you know, contemporary music is a part of rock and roll. In a lot of ways, with musical theater, you know, there are elements of opera at times. There's elements of film in musical theater even. You know, so I think it's kind of an exciting time to do something like this, because really you're constructing your own walls. You're not dealing with pre-existing ones. So there are things that we can do that can approach a more operatic stance, but it really is, wholeheartedly a musical. And it's been fun just kind of delving into some period styles. My grandfather actually was also a composer in the 40s. He was a songwriter, so kind of unearthing some of that from my heritage has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, we hope to hear some of your music out this way. We hope to we'll look forward to anything else that comes out either through CD or of your compositions. So best of success going forward. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two quick questions. The first is a hypothetical, which simply says, if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past, someone I never had a chance to but could, when I ask that, what's the first name that pops into your head? It can get swamped pretty quick, but what's the first name when I ask that?
Stravinsky.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's such a huge figure. It dominated contemporary music when he was in the height of his career, but also somebody who dealt with the insecurities of being a composer and, you know, the trends that were moving all around him and how he fit in with that and how he didn't. And, you know, sometimes I just like to go talk to him. Yeah, maybe it's, I don't know him, so, you know, maybe he wouldn't be very comforting, but, you know, maybe just to gain some insight into.
Yeah, he could be a rough customer at times, but
yeah.
But now that you have historical perspective, it might help.
Right. Exactly.
The final question is non-musical, which means everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy. But when you have to do something that takes you away from your writing or your performing music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but can pull you away when you need to, what do you do?
Oh, I love to ski.
Ah.
Yeah. We take an annual trip to Colorado, and just being in that kind of limitless environment, seeing nothing but white and green for miles and, you know, going down the slopes and the speed. And yeah, it's just kind of everything that I enjoy all in one. And then I do a lot of reading as well.
Yeah, well, being from Chicago, you have to travel to ski. There's nowhere around Chicago.
Right. Well, there's some, and, you know.
Not really. Oh. Well, again, best of success to you, and glad we could spend these moments together. Thanks.
Well, thank you for this. I appreciate it.
Composer, pianist, Misha Zupko. You can find out more about him at his website, Misha, M-I-S-C-H-A, Zupko, Zupko.com. All the music we played today, except for the violin concerto premiere, came from the new recording of his chamber music on the Chicago-based CD Records label. The CD is called Eclipse, and you can check it out at CD Records. It's CEDILLE Records.com. My guest mentioned the video of Eclipse with burlesque singer-dancer Michelle L'Amour, which you can find at her website, Michelle L'Amour, L-A-M-O-U-R.com. I'll leave you with yet a bit more music from my guest's CD of chamber music, the closing minutes from a work whose title might describe a composer of his talent and age. It is called Rising, for violin and piano. Once again, Sang Mi Lee on violin, and the pianist is the composer and was my guest today, Misha Zupko. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.